Everyone, and welcome to Rewatchable, episode number 114. We are currently rewatching Nickelodeon's The Legend of Korra, and today we'll be discussing season 1 of The Legend of Korra, episode 7, The Aftermath, and episode 8, When Extremes Meet. If you would like to contact us, you can do so via email. Our email is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Our Twitter is @re_watchable. You can also comment on this post on hypeable.com, and you can reach us through Tumblr, which is rewatchablepodcast.tumblr.com. My name is Michal, and I am joined by Caitlin.
Hello.
Brittany.
Hello.
And someone who for me is a new voice, but for you is probably not, Jack.
Hello.
Yay, Jack's here.
I forced my way back on again. I didn't have to try that hard either.
And it's early. It's early in the season.
Yeah, I'm excited. Thanks for having me on again.
Everyone else is together in New York or at Indie PopCon, and we're short of bodies available.
If they're together in New York, they left me out, so.
Well, I think it's just Natalie in New York right now. I'm seeing her tomorrow for a play or show.
Oh, nice.
Oh, cool. That'll
be fun.
Anyway, so let's get down into the aftermath. Our synopsis goes as follows. This chapter opens as Bullen and Mako deny Korra's invitation to the air temple. Well, they don't deny it. They reject Korra's invitation to the air temple for Asami's much more glamorous mansion. All is not well at the Sado residence, though, as Korra overhears Hiroshi rejoicing in the fall of Cabbage Corp. Because Cabbage Corp has been taken down for having equalist equipment. An investigation led by Lin finds Team Avatar versus Hiroshi's equalists locked in a battle of electricity and mech suits versus epic and vicious bending. At a vital moment in the struggle, Asami shocks her father with a gun, with a glove, not a gun. There are no guns on the show. At a vital moment of the struggle, Asami shocks her father with a glove, proving both her badassery and rendering herself effectively an orphan. Also, it isn't clear in this synopsis, but Hiroshi Sato is working for Mon. Like, that's like a thing. He's an equalist. Cool. So, you know, early in this episode, things kind of are taking a little, they're relaxing a bit after the intensity of, you know, the fight and everything that happened in last week's episode. And we have some more emotional, feely stuff happening. So, Jack, how did you feel about, you know, Korra's kind of growth with Asami in this episode?
Korra and Asami's, friendship is one of my favorite parts of the show, especially what happens in season two. So get ready for that, girls. So I'm excited to... It was hard for me to sort of watch this sort of beginning stuff of that. So, yeah. I mean, it was still cool to go back and see the beginnings, but I understand that she, you know, is a little bit jealous right now, especially with all this sort of love triangle stuff going on, but yeah.
And Brittany, how did you feel as a newbie?
Well, I felt like they were going to force them together, and this didn't feel as forced as I thought it would. So I thought that was good. I like that she was still kind of like, it wasn't just they jumped in to be friends immediately and they created like this whole brand new, like, you know, gang. I don't want to say gang, but they created this whole
crew. I believe the fandom term is crew with a K.
Oh, right. Crew.
Is that a thing?
That's what I say. You need a word, so.
That's funny.
So I was glad. I liked that she was still jealous in the beginning and everyone's kind of trying to bridge this gap between them. So I think I like them as friends. I don't know yet, though. I don't like Asami that much, so.
Really? Why not?
I don't know. I feel like she's a little... I mean, I get why she's going to be upset later on when we start talking about it, but I feel like she's right now at least in this episode, she's like, she has that little bit of air of entitlement. Like, she knows that she can, like, win people over with the stuff that she has. And she's kind of like a daddy's girl, and it just annoys me.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Going back and rewatching it, I actually remembered that up until this point, or up until the very, very end of this episode, when she pretty much dismantles her father, that I didn't like her as much either. At least she was sketchy to me. I still didn't trust her up until that point. Yeah.
They do a good job of really making you question her allegiance until that last moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think I'll like her a little bit more going forward. Just at this moment, I'm still getting over the hump of the initial impression.
Yeah, I think
that's something that was always funny to me, because when I initially watched it, I didn't like Asami. I was like, you're getting in the way of my ship and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, you look kind of weirdly evil, and I'm not sure why. But then I like, in the middle of the season, around one of these episodes, I rewatched it with my brother, and I realized Asami doesn't know that we think this. You know, Asami doesn't realize that we're painting her as the villain in this triangle, and she's just going on like a normal person who, like, met a guy and is trying to make friends with his friends, you know? So I, you know, I kind of sympathize with her, and that really kind of reversed my opinion of Asami, but definitely there's a lot farther to go there. You know, we definitely see Bolin living it up. We see some drag racing. We see Cora going, nope, with the makeup. Yeah, you know, it's a pretty classy life they have there. Did anything stick out for anyone in the Sato Mansion before we get to what actually sticks out? No? Cool. Yeah, it's not that exciting. Except that Pabu is adorable. So, yeah.
Always
worth noting. Oh my god, yeah, so just dive bombing into the pool. I can't get enough of it. Also worth noting is that Tano, yes, he actually does say Avatar on purpose, because of the movie that shall not be named. And yeah, then we kind of get into the, you know, the meat of the episode, where Korra comes across Hiroshi discussing his plan of attack. You know, he's all happy that Cabbage Corp is going down and that they took the fall, and you know, how did you guys feel? Were you surprised? I think that this definitely was a possibility before, you know, that something sinister might be up Hiroshi's sleeve, if not Asami's sleeve as well. But were you guys surprised? Caitlin, how did you feel about it?
I think initially I was a little bit surprised, and then the more it went on, it was like, oh, of course. And of course they're setting it up with Mako's new girlfriend to really add this unnecessary complication to this relationship stuff that is my least favorite part of the show. So of course they make all that really intriguing, like, underground stuff and then tie it into the less interesting parts.
Yeah, well, that's definitely a big topic that we can discuss. But Brittany, how did you feel about, you know, were you surprised at Hiroshi Sato's true feelings? Did you doubt Korra's convictions? Were you like, maybe you're wrong here, Korra? Or were you like, yeah, no, Korra, you're the main character, so you're right?
No, I definitely doubted Korra. I was like, because in my head I was like, oh, well, that's too easy. I was like, she's definitely wrong, and it's just gonna make everyone kind of doubt her for a little while longer until, but then I thought that this would play out longer. So I was thinking that she would be doubted for maybe an episode or two, and then they'd be like, well, remember that time you tried to, like, call Hiroshi out? Like, I didn't want her to have a win right away, I guess. I don't know why. I like characters to struggle for a very long time.
We have fewer episodes in this.
Yeah, that is very, that's what I was thinking too. I was like, oh, well, this season's almost already over, or at least we've passed the halfway point. So
yeah,
I guess she had to kind of, go ahead, Jack.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, that's like what you guys have mentioned in previous episodes, how it seems like this season does go quite fast, because I didn't know if they were going to get picked up, so they can't, I don't think they have time to sort of dwell on that suspense if he's good or if he's not.
Yeah, but I think, so then I was definitely surprised because it turned over so quickly.
Yeah.
But I buy it, because I remember when we were first talking about, like, first impressions, like, oh, this guy's giving them money and he's doing this, like, he can't just be that good. And I was like, maybe he is that good. Like, I bought his character from the beginning. But yeah, because I think that they were doing a good job of painting Asami as the person to pay attention to, or not her dad. So it was good. I liked it.
Yeah, well, something that stuck out to me about this, as it did in the past, was that I think they did a really good job of creating that doubt. And that's kind of why I don't, like, blame them for giving her this win. Or, like, I don't resent Korra having this win, because she really worked for it. You know, she made, you know, in the context, sacrifices for her convictions. So that kind of, you know, negated any, like, oh, this was easy, because it really wasn't easy. And it wasn't painless either. But speaking of not painless, we have, well, we learn some interesting backstory, obviously. You know, we learn that, oh my God, yes, of course, it was a firebender again. Oh, did we know that? I forget. But it's confirmed that a firebender murdered Asami's mother and that, you know, Hiroshi is, like, all bent out of shape about that for whatever reason. And as things start to unfold about, you know, Cabbage Corp, you know, not, like, evidently not being guilty, and there's this whole, like, setup of, like, the whispering guy in the note, and, like, it's all very noirish. But it leads the crew, basically, to Hiroshi's real workshop, which is, like, under his other workshop. But the only reason it is found is because Lin is able to see with her feet, just like her mother. So let's just... Okay, Brittany, how did you feel about this?
I loved it. I'm going to skip ahead a little, but that's my favorite scene. Like, I thought that was so cool when she, like, took off her, like, little boot thing, and I was like, yes, of course! Like, bringing back the connection and just, like, reminding you of, like, you know, whose daughter she is. Like, I thought that was really cool.
Mm-hmm. And Jack, how'd you feel?
I loved it as well. Like, any reference to Toph, I always love, because she's one of my favorites from Atla, and I love getting any direct connection to the previous generation. Yeah.
And Caitlin, how about you?
It just solidifies how much that Lin is her mother's daughter in so many ways.
So many ways.
So many ways, and this is another great way to show it.
Yeah, well, Lin kind of gets the spotlight a little bit in this episode, and in terms of kind of, you know, doing her police work, and, you know, we kind of get to see her in her element, which then kind of flips and rejects her, I guess. Mm. That's, you know, that's kind of an interesting step in her development. Any other thoughts about Lin before we head down into the scary basement of evil?
And bow down at the shrine of Lin.
Basically.
Yeah, I also felt really bad for her. Like, especially at the end when she's talking to Tenzin, I was like, oh man, like this sucks. Because I feel like she was forced into that place, but now I want her to come back and be awesome and even a badder ass without the law enforcement behind her.
A badder ass.
A badder ass.
Her ass is even badder than before. So they do open up this, you know, secret tunnel. Please tell me that everyone else has secret tunnel playing through their heads as well. Yes.
I did not until this moment.
Yes. So that's in my head now. So the secret tunnel happened. Asami had to stay behind, which, you know, I was like, come on, Mako. But everyone else went down and got their asses handed to them by Hiroshi Sato, who is in a massive mecha suit made out of platinum. And all the other stuff seems to be made out of platinum, too. And it is very, very clear that these mecha suits, you know, the armor that the Equalists have is more than a match for these, like, extremely epic benders. So, Jack, how do you feel about that, you know, fairly epic fight? And in addition, Hiroshi Sato being like, "Mwahaha, I am so evil."
Well, I predicted Hiroshi would be evil. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just visually, like, that he looked that bad, but I never for a second, well, I mean, I first watched this ages ago when it first came out, but I didn't for a second think that he would have been good. So sort of going back to our previous conversation, like, I always thought he had an inkling of evil, but in terms of, like, the actual fight and stuff and what Asami does, I think that speaks volume about how strong she is and just really does stuff for her character. I really like Asami.
Mm-hmm. And Caitlin, how about you? What did you feel about that fight, which is actually, I shouldn't say the first, not at all the first time we've seen these benders again get completely beat up, but I think it's even on a higher level than what we saw in the arena.
Yeah, I kind of love that, like, Avatar is like, we go into the new show and they're like, what didn't we get to do in the first one? I know, mecha suits, let's do it. So they just have a giant army of mecha suits now. Like, of course they do, it's great. So that's cool. And then I was appreciating Tenzin being pretty badass during this fight. He was all over the place, and I love Tenzin, and I love seeing him get to whip out his awesome airbending skills, so that was pretty cool, too. It was just, it was a really well-choreographed fight of everything going on.
That is definitely true, and it was pretty brutal as well, as we, you know, we know there is some stabbing that goes on with, you know, Lin and Equalis, and yeah, the punches are definitely not being pulled in this case. And Brittany, what did you feel about this? Because I think, you know, one of the interesting things about this fight is that, you know, Hiroshi keeps going like, oh, we're taking them to Amon. Like, they're all out and we're going to do this. They're going to Amon. So did you feel that kind of danger, or did you think like, nah, Mako and Bolin are going to save the day and it's all going to be fine?
No, I definitely felt the danger, mainly because up until this point, every time you think that you've seen like the highest evolution of how far they've come in 70 years, there's something else to top it. And like, I feel like Amon is so smart, or at least the people he has working for him are so smart. So I feel like even if these, all of these suits are destroyed, there's something else out there that's being worked on, like as a backup plan. So I definitely felt the danger with these, like watching everyone trying to fight these things and being so helpless, because it just means something bigger and badder is coming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a little nervous.
And how did you feel about that that line that Hiroshi said that, you know, to Lin, like, not even your esteemed mother could take down Platinum?
Yeah, well, first of all, it was just rude because Toph's amazing and she could do anything if she really sets her mind to it.
She'll figure it out.
Yeah. Like, give her a minute to figure out what this element is, like this Platinum nonsense, and she'll figure it out. Yeah, I thought that was such a dig, and I don't like, I mean, not that I don't like it, but I don't like that they're using their parents against them a lot, because we've seen it with the other, like they keep talking about Aang a little bit, and I'm nervous that it's going to stop being special eventually. So I don't know. I mean, it was a great insult. They really had that one in their back pocket, but I think I felt more offended than Lin did in that moment. I was like, oh, no.
No, you don't. Yeah, the Platinum thing is interesting. I don't know. I remember when this first happened, I remember there was a lot of debate like, oh, is Platinum really like that pure? Is it not really like earthy metal? And I don't really care, because it's like the show says that they can't bend Platinum. I'm like, that's fine. They can't bend Platinum. But yeah, I don't know. Jack, how did you feel about that particular detail?
I don't know. Even though I'm, you know, obsessed with the series, I still get sometimes confused about what, especially Earthbenders, what they can and cannot bend. Because it seems like the show will always sort of give us rules when it feels like they want to give us rules and tell us what is and what isn't. So it was just a thing like, oh, so the show's told us they can't bend Platinum. All right, well, I have to believe that, you know. I mean, because I think it would have been just as easy for them to make up a rule as to why they could do it if they've just chosen to go the other direction.
Mm-hmm. Though as we see in the next episode, not all rules are set in stone. That is, you know, things definitely change.
Yeah.
But yeah, so then we kind of, you know, get down to the emotional crux of this episode, which is again interesting because we haven't seen that much comparatively of Asami. But I definitely think that this emotional moment hits home. You know, she comes down, she sees her father, you know, he's an equalist, and he basically gives this impassioned speech to her about how, you know, she needs to join him and creating a new world without benders. And, you know, she appears to go along with it to the point that, you know, Mako even definitely thinks that she has gone over. She puts on the glove and she just like whacks him with electricity. And then, not even that, she takes out the lieutenant. So, yeah, this girl, yeah. Steel right there. Caitlin, how did you feel about the Asami scene looking back?
Ugh, I love Asami. She's, you know, she seems very privileged, and in a lot of ways she is, but you see at this point that she is about to lose everything, and she does it willingly, which is such a huge thing. Like, yeah. Mako and Bolin didn't have a choice in that. And Cora kind of has her own sense of having things, but Asami has had it, and then she makes the choice to give up everything, essentially making herself an orphan, like going against her father. Like, that's not an easy thing, and it's very clear how close she and her father have been. So to be so certain in your morals that you could go against your father, like, in just a split second like that, that's just an incredible show of moral fiber.
Mm-hmm. And because of all that, that's pretty much why Asami is one of my favorite characters, because she is so strong with that. But Brittany, I have a question for you. Did you expect her to do that to her father, like when she's going to go take the glove? Were you expecting it, or were you really surprised by it?
I was a little surprised, only because, like I said, I wasn't completely sold immediately that Hiroshi was a bad guy. So I thought maybe he was, once he saw Asami, he would be like, okay, no, like, it's fine, and she wouldn't have to have that choice. But I like what you guys are saying, because that is true. Like, her having to make that choice does make her a much more interesting character.
Yeah.
And makes her a much stronger character, and you kind of want to root for her from this moment on, because she made this choice. So I was definitely not expecting her to go against her dad that quickly, but yeah, I like what they did with her in this moment, because I thought, again, that Hiroshi was going to be like, I've been manipulated, I'm only doing this to help you, but he's actually just a horrible person.
Yeah. Well, in a lot of shows too, you would see like her go with it and then realize 3 episodes later that, wait, this isn't all it's cracked up to be, and work to stop her father from the inside or something, pretending to be going along with it. No, she's just like, nope, not doing it, and just cuts out all that, which is really refreshing.
I think the reason as well why it is good this way is that it's brought her down to the level of the other 3, because at this point she sort of is just a privileged girl. She has had everything, and her father's, you know, this big billionaire, whatever, but now she hasn't got any of that, so now we can sort of root for her at the same level as the others.
Yeah, and I think the whole privilege, you know, discussion is interesting, especially, you know, when we're talking about Cora, who, like, it's been discussed that she has had everything. Like, obviously it's a very different context, but in terms of having things kind of delivered to you and having things come easy to you, you know, I think Asami and Cora are both now in a position where, you know, Cora's been dealing with this from the beginning of the season with her airbending, but where, like, everything always has been easy. It's not that they necessarily are, like, bitches about it. It's not like they think, like, oh, this is coming to me, but they think that that's just kind of the way their lives have been for various reasons. And now they're both kind of put into a position where they aren't able to achieve those easy things, either by choice. Well, it's sort of by choice in Cora's part as well. But obviously, Asami is a very active choice, and Cora is a very sort of a more like determined, like, oh, I can't do this, I need to do this, you know. But I find that an interesting parallel between them. Yeah. Any other thoughts on this fight or this kind of madness that went on?
Well, she too is also the only non-bender in the group, so she has to show her awesome martial arts skills and be awesome in her own way too. So to prove that she can run with the benders that are around her too, which is great.
Yeah. So, you know, and in the aftermath of this, they it isn't entirely without consequence. Lin's metal benders are kidnapped. And Lin makes her vow that she kind of realizes that she has sort of failed. And I love this idea that Tarlok is, like, hanging over everyone's head, just, like, waiting for the slip-up, you know, and, like, such a politician in that way. And such a kind of adult and realistic and slimy element to have to pay attention to.
Ew, yeah, slimy so... element, ugh. Doesn't sound right.
He is the element of slime. So Brittany, I guess, what did you think about, you know, this ending? Do you think, you know, Lin is gonna go off and be triumphant, or?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I think she's going to, because she has to be. Like, she's not in a position of power now where it's like, well, my actions have, like, you know, public ramifications. Like, they still will, but not in a sense that the public is looking to her as the, like, I guess, what is she, the essential, like, the chief of police, kind of.
Yeah, like, her actions don't reflect the police force. Yeah.
So, now I think she's just gonna go and be really kick-ass and try to get Tenzin away from his wife for a little bit and re-spark that flame and, you know. She's her own woman. She can do what she wants.
Oh, God.
She don't need no man, whatever.
I think that's, yeah. I don't know. Lynn's romantic history is an interesting one, for sure. Yeah, I mean, do we have any other thoughts about this episode? I think the only thing that really stood out to me was just the Cabbage Corp stuff, that, you know, we have that wonderful statue and, you know, that bait
that's
switch.
It's honestly one of my favorite things, because when we wrote that article, when the newbies came together to write that article for our, like, kind of predictions and stuff like that, I said my final line was that the Cabbage Man passed on his cabbage business to his son, and he runs a small stand in, like, the open air market. I did not predict that it was going to become a huge corporation. Like, come on. But good for him.
I still love that, that's actually a thing that they did for this new season. It made Cabbage Corp.
It's perfect.
I still have no idea why it's called Cabbage Corp, but, I mean, it also makes sense within everything. And clearly the taste is genetic, so that's, you know, that's nice. All right, so let's go on to our favorite scenes. Brittany, do you want to go first?
Sure. So my favorite scene was Lynn finding the tunnel using, like, her, like, sonar-y type earthbending that Toph used to use. So I loved that, because her mom probably made her go hang out in a dark tunnel with some moles when she was a baby, which is what I'm thinking. I love that.
Caitlin, how about you?
I chose Asami and Korra kicking butt on the racetrack because it's so refreshing to see them going from the traditional kind of we both like the same guy thing that too many shows do to, hey, let's be friends. Like, the more ladies that are friends, the better.
Very good point. And I do like this kind of, you know, completely unexpected in terms of, like, the context of the world, but, like, this mega skill that Asami has with cars. And she's just, like, an ultra badass behind the wheel. And it's, like, hilarious. Jack, how about you?
My scene was when Marco and Bolin were trying to get past the guard to go into the tunnel, but specifically when Marco was pretending to sneeze and then he sneezes a fire, because he was just being ridiculous and funny. And Marco's usually pretty straight-faced. We don't really get many funny sort of comedic moments from him, so I think it was really cute that we got to see this part here. Just him being a goofball.
He and Bolin had such good choreography, like, right after that. Like, yeah. Bolin comes and, like, drops his elbow on the guy, like, just like that.
Yeah, well, yeah, Marco sneezes, then he falls back, and then Bolin pulls up this rock from the ground to make him fall over himself. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, and then Bolin just, like, womps down on top of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I really liked about that was that, I have to say, well, what I liked / felt bad about was that, like, I don't know, if Lynn gave me an order, I would, like, try really hard to keep it. Yeah. You know, so I felt bad for that guy. It's like, you know, he has hell to pay with his boss if this doesn't work. But I guess he was lucky in the end. He probably didn't get kidnapped by Equalus. And my favorite scene was Asami just taking down her dad and then the lieutenant, because she is a star. And yeah, basically. Brittany, what's your favorite line? I hate you. You stole the best line of the episode.
I got to the dock super early, so my favorite line is, not my Cabbage Corp.
Caitlin, how about you?
So mine is Bolin and Mako and Asami have come down to rescue everybody, and Bolin has Tenzin over his shoulder, and Sato comes in and he's gesturing with Tenzin's arms as he speaks. He's like, hello, Mr. Sato. Wow, what a really swell, scary factory you have under here, under your giant mansion. And you can't see me, but I'm gesturing awkwardly right now. The gesturing is what makes that line.
Well, I love that too because, like, yeah, it's they aren't afraid to kind of like poke fun, even though like Tenzin is unconscious and like that's a serious moment, yeah. You know. But you can still kind of laugh at it. Jack, what's your favorite line?
Mine is Bolin as well. Just before that scene when they actually find the tunnel, and all Bolin just he just whispers, "Do you think your dad knows about this tunnel?" And it was just really funny to me. I love Bolin.
Yeah. That I love because the look on Asami's face is like so like stricken and like obviously her world just changed and he's like ha ha.
Yeah, like he peeks over her shoulder. Do you know about this tunnel?
And my favorite line, which is actually I don't think this is like from Korra or anything, but I just really like it. It's when Asami is like, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. And I also love it because I think it's kind of a red herring, you know, it's kind of like, ooh, maybe she's evil. She's like bending the rules. And then you find out that the person that she was bending the rules against is the one who's evil. So it all kind of works out. It all equalizes, as they say.
But ba-dum-ching.
On that note, let's move on to a less equalist centric episode, but definitely an antagonist centric episode, chapter 8, When Extremes Meet. The synopsis is as follows. In this chapter, Asami, Bolin, and Mako are introduced to Air Temple Island, their lifestyle, which is, you know, separate dorms, which is adorable, complete with Iki revealing Korra's feelings toward Mako. As a rift forms between the girls, Tarlok abuses the political power he's gained by asking the new chief of police, who is actually the worst, to abuse all non-benders. The crew decides to take action by listening to the police scanner in the Sodomobile. After pissing off Tarlok by capturing runaway Equalists, Korra threatens to crush the bastard at a non-bender rally. And then Mako, Bolin, and Asami are arrested, and that is Korra's last straw. Korra confronts Tarlok at the town hall at night, and soon he's aiming to kill. This pisses off our vivacious avatar beyond belief, and just as it seems she's won the upper hand, Tarlok bloodbends and tosses her in a car to get her out of the way. And say goodbye to Republic City, Avatar. You'll never see it again.
Mwahaha.
That was creepy.
That was so creepy. Yeah, this was one of the episodes that I really remember, like, standing up from my couch as the end was happening and being like, what is going on? I'm like, God!
Yeah, I love this episode.
They really mess with your mind a good few times this season. So, you know, going back to a slightly lighter topic, we do see the gang or crew all move onto Air Temple Island, which is kind of funny. The Airbender kids, I think, are definitely the highlight.
Milo was the best.
I liked Iki when she gets locked out of the room, like that series of faces she goes through and like animal noises.
I just love before that when she's like, "I'll show you to the boys part of the thing," and I'm like, "Yeah, damn, get it, girl. You go, try for it."
Yeah, Iki definitely doesn't have like limits. She doesn't have that's not in her brain yet. That hasn't occurred. Brittany, what did you think about all this?
I like Mitch's first question about his Air Temple Island. Like, do they have to take a boat every time? Because I've had that question too. Because when they get the car, are they on Air Temple Island or did they leave? And if they take like her polar bear dog, like they're clearly just waking the polar bear dog up isn't going to do anything unless they swim, right? Or does she like waterbend herself to other places?
I'm having flashbacks to like May of 2012 debating this question. I'm pretty sure we had the same debate and I have no idea what the answer is.
But it was something I was definitely paying attention to in this episode. Maybe, and I don't know why.
Maybe they took a sky bi- I mean, obviously, it like makes more sense for the airbenders to live on an island because they have sky bison. But I don't know about... I think Asami was in the city. That makes more sense.
Yeah, that definitely makes more sense. But I was just wondering, because I don't think they would have a car on the island to begin with. Like, you know, it wouldn't just randomly be there.
Yeah. Well, they did have one, the one that Tarlok gave Korra.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That's not the same car, but...
But you're right. They did have one at one time.
I think the best part about this scene was Iki revealing her to Asami that Cora likes Marco. Like, it was just so, like, hey, do you know this? And then Cora's reaction right after was so funny. It was perfect timing. I loved it.
Yeah, that is the gift that has been gift. A million gifts.
Yeah.
And it's pretty accurate, I think. That it's yeah. Because I wasn't expecting her to say that. I also love Milo just like being creepy and ridiculous the whole time.
That was gonna be my second favorite scene.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely worthy. So then we kind of we get to the crew starting to take action. This is after Cora has her little sad moment though. Which, because, you know, she has some interactions with Tarlok, and he's basically like, you are not the Avatar, you can't tell me what to do, you can't even airbend. And she gets very upset about that, and, you know, kind of has a little tear-bending moment. And then the crew kind of reunites, and you know, they decide to take on the world together, which is just awesome and very heartwarming. Caitlin, what'd you think about the... Team Avatar, hooray, / Milo farting on everyone's hand.
Well, I chose that minus the Milo farting scene as my favorite scene for the episode. So we'll say I liked it a lot. It was great because it's always nice when they kind of go back to the whole thing of like, hey, friendship is very much at the core of the show. It was at the core of Avatar, and it's going to be at the core of Korra. Ha ha.
Mm-hmm.
So... And it was, like, very Power Rangers, and they're all, like, putting their hands in the middle. Like, go team! Like, that was my first thought, and I don't know why, but it was. And it was cute, and then, but kind of cliche, so of course they had to have Milo farting on it, because he's Milo, and that's what he does.
What better way to break the tension? Also worth noting, Pabu comes and licks the tears off of Korra's face, which is just...
Oh, so cute.
So then, you know, the crew does... however they get back to Republic City proper, they do start to kick ass and take names in the car, and they work really well together, like, impressively, impressively well. You know, like, Asami knows just when to tell them that she needs a ramp, and they know when to do it, and, like, everybody's working in sync. It's really awesome.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, Jack, what were your thoughts on that initial chase?
Well, jumping ahead, this is my favorite scene, so I thought it was awesome.
I'm just, like, hitting everybody's favorite scenes at this point.
how they do the ramp around the side, and they use the car to go up it, and especially Bolin's earthbending. It was just beautiful, and I'm always a sucker for a good car chase in anything, so, yeah, this is really great.
And it felt like a car chase, which is really, you know, interesting again for kind of an animated Nickelodeon series. Like, it felt like an intense car chase.
Yeah, and I like how it's just one of the moments where it's so drastically different from Atla, and they're not limiting mm-hmm. themselves to what they couldn't do in the first season. So, like, hey, why not we just chuck a car chase in here just 'cause? And it was awesome. And it worked well.
Yeah, and using bending to, like, facilitate that, which is really cool.
And they don't second-guess each other or anything. You know, Zombie's just like, I need a ramp. And they're like, there you go.
Yeah.
It works so well.
Yeah.
Agreed. But then, you know, Triumph kind of turns a little bit sour because they run into the non-bender or the equalist activity, quote-unquote, turns out to be the first implementation of Tarlok's basically anti-non-bender initiative, which is that all their lights are turned off, and they're like, why are our lights turned off? And they're like, and then the police are like, we'll beat you up because you're mad that your lights are turned off. And Cora gets stuck in the middle. Brittany, what did you think about, you know, this initial part of discovering that, I guess, delivering justice is not as easy as it initially seems.
I was glad that they ran into, it was Tarlok who was initiating all of this stuff, because I really wanted to see what he had up his sleeve. And I'm glad that he's the one behind it, because I just don't like him, and I want Team Avatar to go against him full force. But I think that it felt like a heavier issue than just someone saying like, okay, turn off your lights. Like, it was just being older and watching this show. Like, this felt like such a serious, serious issue where I think it would go over the heads of some kids watching it.
Yeah.
So I was surprised by how like deep it was watching it, especially after like you're just sitting in the car with Team Avatar and they're like making ramps and kind of doing like the Spider-Man vigilante, I have a police scanner, I can stop people robbing banks type of stuff. That's what that beginning made me think of, when Peter Parker's just like listening to a police scanner and is like catching pictures of himself, you know?
Right.
But then like you get to this moment and you're like, wow, okay, this is actually, I have to think about this a little bit more than just sit back and watch them fighting crime.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's kind of funny that it is kind of increasingly relevant as time goes by. But, you know, of course, this doesn't get better. It actually gets worse because Tarlok shows up again. And not only do the non-benders not get any justice, but Asami is arrested for being in league with Hiroshi somehow. And then Mako and Bolin are arrested for being in league with Asami. And basically the only reason why Tarlok can't arrest Korra is because she's Korra. This is really interesting. You know, obviously we have the metalbending police who are, you know, following these orders. Like, do we judge them? Like, is this a good thing that you have this really, really, really super effective police force? Who can be used, you know, for good or evil. Caitlin, what do you think about that?
I think this is starting to show, like, how dangerous it is. Like, this is basically the dangers of martial law, because that's, like, Tarlok has essentially been given complete power over all of this. And so he's kind of militarizing this and doing everything to his own desires, and it's really showing how dangerous it is for him to have all the powers, because on a normal day you couldn't arrest them for being in league with somebody when it was clear they had nothing to do with what Hiroshi was up to. So very dangerous, and kind of like what Brittany was talking about before, is it's a much heavier issue than you expect, like this kind of militarization of the police force issue that they're dealing with, and it sort of takes you off guard a little bit with how intense that can be.
Yeah, and I mean, more than just a little bit, I mean, you have that woman who's like holding a baby, and she's like, you know, you're our avatar too, and that's, you know, obviously a big deal. And Jack, how did you feel about this whole situation?
Well, as Brittany said, yeah, I think a lot of it would go over the heads of the younger audience watching this, but as, like, you know, older people watching it, we can really appreciate the severity and the weight of what's actually happening, especially with, like, what you just said, where with the baby and that family. Like, that really hit home to me, seeing that. I didn't remember it, and it was unexpected, but in a good way.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, they get shipped off. They, you know, tell Korra that they'll be okay. Korra spends some time trying to get, you know, her friends out of jail, but she kind of comes up again into this helplessness that she's been battling the whole season, basically, is, you know, kind of Korra confronting her own helplessness. Actually, most of the show is that, now that I'm thinking about it. You know, she basically does a similar thing to what she does in episode 4, you know, when she basically challenges Amon to that fight out of, you know, fear and bravado and just kind of a desire to, like, punch the problem away. And she goes to confront Tarlok, and Tarlok is basically expecting her. So, Brittany, how did you think this was going to go down? Like, we haven't seen Tarlok. Well, I guess we have seen him bend a little bit, but not, you know, in a real battle way. How did you, like, did you think, like, oh, Korra will just take him out, or how did you see this going?
Well, I could tell just because of how, like, you were describing him earlier, how slimy he is, because who else would wear 3 ponytails?
Of course.
Plus, he just looks like he would be very powerful, but I really thought that Korra would have an edge on him just because she can do a little bit more. She has fire, she has earth. Yes, she can't airbend yet, but she can also waterbend, so she can, like, do a lot, but I was amazed at how powerful he was. And all I kept thinking the whole time was, get him away from that waterfall. Like, I was so frustrated. I'm like, just get him away from the waterfall. Oh, but it was so cool. This whole fight was just so cool. And I mean, when we were watching Avatar, most of my favorite scenes were the, like, really well choreographed fight scenes. I love watching bending, and I know that some people were like, I don't know, it takes away from time that stuff could actually be happening. So this whole fight scene, I was in it. I love it. I love watching bending. So it was great. Yeah.
Well, the show is, I've never heard that opinion before. The show is about bending. I want to see all the cool fights and, you know, the beautiful animation as much as I can, especially when it goes into the slow motion stuff and, like, the little icicles are, like, piercing her skin and, like, cutting off her hair. Oh, it was stressful.
And I think, you know, the reason why it works is because it's not just like, oh, hey, let's see these two people fight. Like, it's a conflict. It's not just a fight, you know, and it's a very deep and significant conflict. So I think, you know, we're obviously rooting for Korra, but we're also scared for her in terms of, like, is she doing the right thing? Is she, you know, giving into her, like, darker nature? You know, I think that, and that's something that I think this fight directly wants us to ask. Like, how did you feel about that, Caitlin? Especially as, you know, Korra basically, like, it goes up basically to sort of kill Tarlok.
Yeah, she gets super intense during this whole thing, but, you know, he's doing the same. I think what I really took away from this fight, especially the first time, was just how dangerous Tarlok is, because he comes across very much as just the slimy, sleazy politician, and there's a lot of danger in that in its own way. Like, we know he's a bender because he was heading the task force, but we didn't really realize until this fight just how dangerous he was, both politically and as a bender. So it really amps up the danger that he poses, not only to Korra, but to really the entire city, when you recognize how many ways he can cause damage to the people that we care about.
Right. And of course, that ultimate reason is, or potential is revealed at the end of the fight, when Tarlok studs to bloodbend. So, I mean, I remember just watching this and being like, utterly just aghast and shocked, and I don't even remember if, like, the specifics of, like, the full moon came to me in that moment, but I remember just being utterly flabbergasted. And I just want to go to Brittany first, because how did you feel?
I wasn't expecting the bloodbending at all. I was like, yeah, he's got some cool ice moves, but now he's out of water, like, this is it. But I was like, I was so ready for Korra to just, like, have a bigger person moment and walk away because she knew that she had the clear advantage. And this happened, and I was like, you should have murdered him while you were just standing there. I was like, what are you doing? And I completely forgot about bloodbending until this moment happened. And it was just, I forgot how bad it was, because I was rooting for Katara to bloodbend so much, but then watching Tarlok do it, my opinion just completely changed. I'm like, no, no more bloodbending. No one's allowed to bloodbend ever again.
Yeah, that's an opinion that definitely comes up again. Jack, how did you feel?
I actually forgot that he bloodbended, but I forgot that it happened at this moment, and it was just a nice refresher after the whole intensity of the fight. Like, it's sort of our discussion before about how if people don't like the fight, but, like, this has emotional ramifications at the end, and especially at this part. And, yeah, I just loved it. It was the perfect, like, climax to this whole confrontation.
And Caitlin, how about you?
It does such a good job of ramping up the horror of this whole thing. Like, you're really into it, like, with adrenaline as it's going, and then all of a sudden it's just, like, slams on the brakes and is like, horror, oh my god, like, and it's just the shifting emotions is crazy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, because I think this scene is all about escalation, obviously. You know, Korra escalates this conflict by going over there, and, you know, Tarlok has been escalating this conflict beforehand. But I think it's, you know, it's really, really interesting the way they play with your expectations that you know, again, like the fight is so brutal, like Korra's like bleeding, you know, and she's the Avatar, and like she can, it's like barely all she can do to, like, she has to physically punch away those pieces of ice, and then, you know, it just keeps going up and up and up, and then we hit this moment where it like can't escalate any further because they've like played the Avatar universe ace, at least, you know, as far as we know it at this point. And yeah, that seems, I think, you know, it's really masterfully done. So obviously the rest of us can't really speculate on this, Brittany, but, what do you think? Like, how do you think Tarlok learned how to bloodbend? Do you think that he's like a magical waterbender, or like, do you think that, what do you think the whole deal is with the full moon and being able to bloodbend however and whenever he wants, apparently?
Yeah, I honestly didn't remember the moon thing being an issue. I thought, and then I was like, oh, well, maybe the full moon like makes you like there's literally nothing you can do to stop it, and maybe like a lesser moon there's more preventative things someone can do to like stop someone from bloodbending. But I think maybe he has some backstory that we're going to get eventually that's not necessarily going to make us feel sorry for him, but just understand his motivations a little more. So I'm just waiting for that. I have a feeling that that's going to come, because they wouldn't just set up this character to not explain what's going on with him.
And something else that happens, obviously, you know, in this fight, Korra has another hallucination. More detailed.
This one, yeah, was horrible. Horrible, yeah. To watch.
Nobody's happy in this particular one. They're all, I don't know. Brittany, could you figure out what was going on in there? I'm not sure if I should, like, say it.
I don't know. Well, I definitely don't know what was going on in it, but I just remember Tenzin being like, what was the problem here? What were they feeling? What did you see everyone doing? And like, you could tell that they were all in so much like agony, and like Aang just looked so helpless. Like he was trying to do something and he couldn't do it. And then Sokka's like, first of all, I cannot see any more Sokka. Like, can they stop showing him? Because it's too heartbreaking. Like, no more Sokka in flashbacks. Because every time they show him, I'm just like, oh no, come on. I don't know why his death is hitting me the hardest, but it is. Like, yes, Aang is dead, but at the same time, Sokka is also dead.
Aang is one thing.
Aang is one thing. Like, I get it, because Korra's here, so I'm over it. But, like, Sokka didn't have to die, guys.
What's the point in going on when Sokka is dead?
But, yeah, they all looked so terrified and scared. And when the first flashback happened, I, like, stopped, like, what I was watching, and I kind of, like, went back through it and, like, kind of, like, paused it like frame for frame, because I just wanted to see what they looked like. It was more of a curiosity thing. But this one, I just rewatched it straight through. I didn't actually like stop it. I just would watch the flashback straight through, and it hurt. Like, it was like emotionally like charged. Like, I don't know what's going on, but they're definitely in some kind of danger. And I think that it goes with what Tenzin's saying, like, they're your past. She has to get in touch with that because Aang's trying to tell her something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is another character in that flashback that, if you felt like going through it again, might give you some hints. But that's all I'll say about that.
Toph was in it too, right?
Yes. Yeah. But going back to the present day, I'm not going to say what some friends of mine would call this little situation, because it's not really PG-13, but... when we were discussing it at the time, but Tarlok does load Korra into a van. She's all tied up. She's basically helpless. And, you know, he's taking her somewhere else and he is doing something with her. So, you know, sorry to put you on the spot again, Brittany, but as our only newbie, what are your theories?
Well, I want to go watch it as soon as this is over, because I wasn't on last week, so I had 4 episodes to watch, and I'm like, yeah, 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 and then it ended like this, and I was like, no, I have to stop watching it right here. I don't know where he's going to take her. I feel like he's definitely, it has to do with something with the Equalist, because he's being a little too, like, he wants everyone away for a while, and he's, like, kind of separating Bender, so he's leading some kind of, like, I don't know if he's going to turn... like her over to an equalist thing or turn her over to like a pro bender rally. I don't know. He's definitely a pro bender. Like, I don't know if he has his own army that he's building up or whatnot, but I feel like he's going to dump her somewhere anonymously in the, to the hands of the equalists. But I don't know why I feel that way, because it doesn't make sense for anything that I just said would be his agenda. But that was my first thought.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Caitlin or Jack, do you guys want to share any of your impressions, like, that you remember? Or just because I remember thinking at this point, and I won't say whether or not this is accurate, but, you know, being episode 8, I kind of thought, you know, we had shifted in antagonists. I kind of thought, you know, we were, like, Amon was a big deal, but now Tarlok is really, you know, the big bad. And so did any of you guys feel that way, or?
I'm not sure. When I first watched it, I sort of, like, binge-watched it all, so I don't think I gave myself time to think that far ahead for myself.
And Caitlin, what about you?
Yeah, I don't remember thinking that they were necessarily connected, but looking at it now, it's like, well, who does it benefit to take Korra out of the picture? Gee, that's interesting. Sure seems to benefit the Equalists. That's a strange place for a bender to be on the side of. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So I can... It seems logical, but then it's like, but totally illogical at the same time. So I don't remember what I was thinking the first time, but I do remember being like, oh my God, I think that was the main reaction.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think the main thing to take away from this is that, you know, not that Avatar was simple by any means whatsoever. And that's not at all what I mean to say, but you know, you just can't trust people on Korra. Like, they will say things and then do the opposite. And I think that's, you know, something that you just don't see like that directly on, you know, animated shows, on kids shows. And that's, you know, always something that's impressed me a lot, that people's motivations are not as simple as they appear. Okay, so yeah, those are two super intense episodes, and they don't really get any less intense, to be completely honest, from here on out. But let's go to our favorite scenes. Brittany, how about you? Took the best one, of course.
Well, like I said, got to the dock early, I guess. it was.
Yeah, but I'm always like, nobody's going to be there.
I had literally just finished watching the episodes when Mitch was like, "Doc's done," and I was like, "Yes, I'm in." So it was definitely Tarlok and Korra's fight was my favorite scene. I loved it so much, and I loved being so caught up in it and just being like, "You have to destroy the waterfall!" Like, I didn't. It always catches me off guard when I suddenly realize how invested I am in the show when I'm watching it. So I like that.
And Caitlin, what about you?
As I mentioned earlier, mine was the formation of the new Power Rangers team, the new Team Avatar, and they're all friendship forever, and it's cute, and the drama ensues.
And Jack?
Yeah, as I mentioned, mine is the big race around the city, and furthermore, what Caitlin said, them all working together and being great friends and knowing exactly what to do and when to do it, but especially, yeah, Bolin's earthbending and how he was a big major factor in making the ramps and using his rocks to get the baddies. And yeah, it was awesome.
And mine is sort of corollary to that, but at the beginning, you know, when the crew jumps on Naga's back and they're like, aha, and the music's all triumphant, and Naga's like, LOL, no, this is not happening. So Brittany, what was your favorite line?
Okay, so my favorite line this week was, calm down, Korra. I'll get it sorted out. We just need to be patient. But you really are the worst. Ever. When Tenzin turns around to talk to him, I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen, because I was not expecting it. Because there are those moments where, like, Tenzin kind of, like, blows up a little bit. But then when I thought he was really going to keep his calm in this moment, and he didn't. And he, like, just points at him, and it was so good.
Yeah, that I was writing that one, and then I was like, no, darn it, Brittany got it.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. Caitlin, how about you?
So mine is when Bolin and Asami and Mako have first gotten to the island, and the air kids are offering to show them around. So Bolin just rapid fires. I have a couple of questions. Is this an all-vegetarian island? Is that where you train airbending? Do we have to wear air acolyte clothes? Do we each get our own sky bison? Final question, how many trees are on this island? And Icky takes just a moment and then she goes, yes, yes, no, no, 10,552. Everyone just kind of like eyes wide stares at her answering it. Just, oh, so good.
And Jack, what about you?
Mine's that scene as well with Milo when he's talking to Asami. And this is going to be my favorite scene, but I couldn't help but put that first one on there. So I chose a line from that one and I said, we will meet again soon, beautiful woman. Because he's just so cheeky. And usually, like, the little kids, like, not in this show, but in, like, other shows, that sort of annoys me when there's, like, the younger kid going after the older woman. And it's like that trope in comedies. And that kind of annoys me. But they do it really, really well in Korra. So I love Milo and I loved all that. It was hilarious.
Yeah. So I'm going to take the mood down with mine and say that my favorite line was when Korra is confronting Tarlok and she goes, like, she has the flame in her hands and he's like all disheveled and like broken on the floor. She's like, still think I'm a half-baked avatar. And it's like, yikes, yikes. I'm not sure which one of you I'm more scared of in this moment. But yeah, that was quite intense. Yeah, so that brings us to the end of our discussion for these two episodes today. If you would like to leave us any comments, as we said before, you can contact us via email, which is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, on Twitter, which is @re_watchable, this post on hypable.com, or our Tumblr. You can also leave us an iTunes review, which we will very much appreciate, especially if you leave us 5 stars, in which case Karen will not spill the secret about your crush to your crush's bae. Like, oh God, threat. I can't believe he made me say bae. Why did I? Oh. All right, so we have some great Twitter feedback and actually a ton of feedback.
We have a ton of feedback. I took one out just because the rest of them I was like, it was just we're going to be crunched, so we're going to go super quick.
All right, so we'll just go in a cycle. So I'll just start and then yeah, we'll tag team it. All right. Danny, Cerulean Snidget, says, I would like to hear Caitlin attempt to send an impression. Her bring my mother into it had great potential. I actually think we should save this. I feel like we should save it for another time.
We should save it for when we have like a really great Tenzin line and Caitlin's going to be on.
Unless you would like to go now and treat us.
I don't have a Tenzin impersonation, so it's not going to work.
Okay. Okay. Well, we have plenty of time. Brittany, you want to take the next one?
Sure. So Mariah Lovegood says on Twitter, I got my cousin to start both VMARS and Firefly. She was addicted to VMARS and started and finished season one in 48 hours. Jesus. That's my kind of binge watcher. I love it. Keep going and then listen to the podcast too.
Caitlin, take the next one.
Blaze Anderson @BlazyAshley tweeted, not another Teen Wolf podcast. I just started listening because I heard about it on Rewatchable. Thanks, Karen, Danya, Natalie, Mitch. So shout out.
None of them were here today. So.
Yeah. shout out to not another Teen Wolf podcast.
Not
I've
a Teen Wolf.
I've been on the show a few times, so I'll take a snidget
of Jack,
credit.
Take all of it.
Jack, can you take the next one?
Lynn Walker, who is Oh Hey It's Lynn, says, re-listening to rewatchable episodes for Atla and all the Katara hate really makes me super duper sad. This week's episode is fantastic. Now I just want a time machine to be able to listen to next week. Aww.
Yeah, at the beginning of rewatchable for Avatar, we were not fans of Katara. Well, at least I wasn't.
Yeah, you guys really opened my eyes to Katara. I never had a problem with her until, like, listening to you guys. I was like, oh, she really isn't that great, is she? Changed my opinion.
I'm sorry.
I like Katara. Stephanie Merrill, @StephanieMerrill, says, I just started listening to the Atla rewatch, and you're all giving me so many feels. Stop it. Stop it right now. Okay. Well, we're done with Avatar, so we're done. But we still have the feels, to be honest. Yeah. Caitlin, can you grab the next one? Or Brittany, Zach. Actually, that's the way it goes. Brittany.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So Zach at Zach H Official says, "And the winner is the episode that got me hooked. It was so intense, and that was all it took for me back then. This was it. Pema, is that? I always Pema. Forget Pema. Yeah, okay. This Pema versus Lynn conversation is killing me. Hashtag Tenzin is a breeder. Apparently, I'm going to live tweet the new rewatchable episode, which we highly recommend."
That was so funny. I listened to last week's episode, and Ariana and Natalie were killing me with that Tenzin breeding stuff.
I know. It was so good. I sometimes don't listen to the ones if I'm not on it, but I went back and listened to it because everyone was freaking out about it. So, good funny. Job.
I haven't listened to it, but I can kind of imagine. And Caitlin, can you take the next one?
Gleek Forever 22 at Gleek Freak 22 says, "OMG, Ariana's synopsis was gold. Hashtag HSM and Cora. I'm not sure I even want to know because I haven't listened to the episode either."
Oh my god, is that High School Musical?
Yeah, it is. It was pretty much just a recap of High School Musical 1, I think.
Yeah, it was good. It's really good. I recommend it.
Jack, can you take Daniel's comments?
Yep, so this is from Hyperball. So Daniel Stewart says, "When it comes to how suddenly things are being introduced in Korra and how quickly the story is moving, I think you have to consider the writing restrictions that come with a 13-episode season versus Atla, where they had the luxury of 20 episodes per season to slowly build the story and characters." So we've touched on that as well, how we understand that they have only had a shorter time to really flesh out this arc, so things may seem a little bit rushed.
Yeah.
And I think that we had the opposite problem on Avatar, where we were like, "You don't have time for a field trip." I'm like, "A comet is coming." And here we're like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, slow down, go on a field trip, have a good time." So I think it's interesting, like, how differently we're, at least a newbie like myself, is looking at the pacing of it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's something that the creators mentioned at some point as well, that like with Avatar it would be like, "No filler, stop with the filler," and then, you know, for Korra it would be like, "What are you doing? Like, where is this show? We need filler." It's, you know, it goes back and forth. I think the show could probably stand to be a few episodes longer, but I don't know, it's all network stuff and all that. So Sophia Malik also commented, and she said that, "First, I wanted to say that this episode has forever changed the way I see Pema. Secondly, Tenzin says that the reason that he and Lynn broke up, apart from Pema swooping in and stealing him, was because they were growing apart and had different goals. Maybe Lynn wanted to focus on her career and didn't want to have kids, but Tenzin did, and he obviously needs to reproduce to repopulate the world with airbenders, so that's why they broke up." That is a good theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Brittany, you want to take the first... Actually, you know what? You're going to read the iTunes review. So, yeah, Caitlin, why don't you take the email?
So this email is from Natalia Neville. It says, "Hey, I just wanted to let you all know how excited I am that it's finally Legend of Korra time. Woohoo! I was kind of stalking my iTunes feed for a while until the new episode showed up. Well, we're glad to have shared them with you. So on another note, I finally started watching Veronica Mars because of the podcast, and I was very pleasantly surprised. The only thing I regret is waiting until the week before my finals to do this. I hope you were not permanently scarred the way I was by Veronica Mars right before your finals. I have a few things to comment on regarding Legend of Korra and Atla. One, the soundtrack is really moving, and I almost teared up when I heard it on your introductory episode. Two, both shows have a really special place in my heart, not only because they are great in storytelling character development, but because I watched them when I was around the age of the protagonists. During your Atla run, I remember you guys always commenting on the gang's age and the fact that Aang is a 12-year-old kid, which is really funny for me because I remember watching Atla as it airs and thinking, like, wow, a 12-year-old must be so much more mature and Asian since I was around 7 or 8 at the time. Keep up the awesome work, and greetings all the way from Brazil."
Brazil!
Thank you. Cool.
All right, and let's do our iTunes episode, which Brittany is going to read. Thank you, Mitchell, for typing this all out.
Yeah, because they don't let you copy and paste them, so good job, Mitch. So this is from M. Clark 14, and it is titled "Amazingly Awesome Podcast," and we got 5 stars. And the review is, this podcast is definitely one of my favorites that I have ever listened to. I found it as they were starting Avatar The Last Airbender, and ever since I have listened weekly. I love the concept of super fans and newbies in the podcast. It offers the listeners different levels of opinions on the material, some who are rewatching and have a vast knowledge of the show, and some who may know nothing about the show except what they've seen. It's just an awesome idea. Also, I love how they interact with their listeners. I talk to them frequently on Twitter as Avatar Central. What's up? I love Avatar Central.
Yeah, what's
I talk
up, to them Avatar Central?
All the time on Twitter. And they always either reply, favorite, or retweet. Everyone on the podcast does a super job. Now I'm listening weekly with Legend of Korra episodes, and I find myself eager to find out their thoughts every week. This podcast is so great, and I'm happy that I found it. We're happy you're here.
Aww.
Thanks for sticking around after Avatar.
Very much. Very, very much. And again, you guys can, well, Avatar Central, you can pester Karen for your reward. I don't remember which one it is, but there's plenty to choose from.
Yeah, you know what? You can pick whatever you want.
Yeah, go for it. Do one of the reproduction ones. I like those.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been Rewatchable. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with episodes 9 and 10, and they're insane. I am Michal.
I'm Brittany.
I'm Caitlin.
And I'm Jack.
Flameo Hotman.
Bye.
Bye.